Per la serie To Be Made, al Festival dell'Arte Contemporanea di Faenza, Germano Celant ha intervistato Dan Graham, un critico e un artista legati da un rapporto di amicizia e collaborazione che dura da quasi 40 anni e che li ha portati dapprima a vivere il fermento artistico della New York degli anni 60 e 70 e che li ha visti poi impegnati insieme in vari progetti artistici, e basti pensare a Arti Ambiente per la Biennale di Venezia del 76 o Arti Architettura a Genova nel 2004. Qui ripercorrono le tappe salienti della carriera artistica di Graham, da Homes for America alle innumerevoli collaborazioni con artisti e musicisti, dall'esperienza didattica alla Nova Scotia College of Art e dai testi critici di Rock My Religion, alla progettazione dei pavilion, dall'ibridazione dei supporti all'uso dell'umorismo come strumento critico. La riflessione spazia poi in modo più ampio al rapporto tra arte e architettura, tra arte e design, al ruolo sociale del museo, alla logica corporate che si sta imponendo in quanto a modelli di sviluppo di organizzazione in ambito museale e che sta trasformando l'arte in commodity. L'intervista è in inglese.
Buongiorno, il mio nome è Germano Celant. It's very difficult for me to start because our relationship dates about 40 years in a certain way, starting in the 60s, when I came to New York in 1968, and we cross each other sometimes in bars like Max Kansas City, all these kind of things. And also we cross when we did the Biennale in 1976 and then, 2004 and so on and so on. So I would like to start asking you some question about your position, but also position of your generation in the 60s, when, the idea to overpass the pop and the minimal. I think, you are a very important figure in order to go ahead after this kind of rigidity, absolute, strong image, iconic or not iconic by the minimal. So the idea that when you start in 1965, 66 was to go ahead and to overpass and to create a new way of working with the minimal aspect and the pop aspect. I'm referring naturally to the Home for America, which was a piece that include a kind of minimal approach to the housing, to the urban landscape, and the use of magazine as a kind of pop culture. How you envision today, after 40 years, this kind of position? How you feel to be one who start this kind of, not conceptual period, because I don't think that's the correct term, but different approach to art, which is not an object, which is not a commodity, which is not something that is physical, but is more printed matter and information.
First, I want to say my introduction to Germano wasn't Max's Kansas City. Although I used to go to Max's Kansas City, I saw some of the last concerts of Velvet Underground. I had his book about Giulio Pellini, which was an amazing book. And then the most important show I was in 78 was the Ambiente in the Venice Biennale. It got me involved in work that was between art and architecture. It was an absolutely amazing show. I want to give you my history. I didn't go to art school or college. Friends of mine started a gallery, so I became the manager, knowing nothing about art. I wanted to be a writer, and I met Saul LeWitt. And Saul and I liked the same French writer, Michel Butor, very much. So I became an artist-writer. The big influence on me was Dan Flavin, who said his neon lights after the exhibition should go back to the hardware store. Saul LeWitt did a show that had wood, and he said it should be used for firewood. And one of my heroes was Roy Lichtenstein, who said he was using cheap magazine printed matter, putting on painting to destroy painting. So in fact, the contradiction was we wanted art to be free, mass production, and these artists started doing work that was valuable, so my idea was to put things directly in magazine pages, which would be disposable. And the work also was a hybrid, because all my work is a hybrid. It was somewhere between magazine pages, criticism in magazines, and art. So it was very efficient, and this comes really from the minimal artist's idea of doing things that were minimal and efficient and very efficient. My work was a critique of the gallery, because actually the gallery sold nothing, so my work was always placed in public media, but you're right. And Homes for America was not a critique of minimal art. It was basically a fake think piece. It was fake sociology, and it was about humor. And I think it came a lot from, it was a lot like Flaubert, and it was also about the city plan of being the subject of my work, not the white cube. Saul Witt and I love Michel Butor, who did novels about the labyrinth of the city. But my work has always been a hybrid, and my way of subverting things was through humor, maybe a Jewish point of view. I did Side Effects, Common Drugs, which was drugs that women housewives would take. It was based on Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones. The idea was to put things in magazine pages which would be disposable.
You said that when you start, you are an artist writer. And this is a figure that doesn't exist in Europe in a certain way. It came very late. While Donna Judd was a writer, you know, Bob Morris was a writer, you were a writer. So it's a very specific situation for an American in order to survive. You know, you have a second job doing a truck in New York and or doing, you know, kind of housing and everything. Or you, like Judd and Bob Morris, were a writer. Here, there was a very strong distinction between artists, critics, curator, and so on. While the traditional American come, you know, through you or through Joseph Kossuth and all these people were taking not only a position as creative people, but also a theoretical position. So I think that's very important. If you can explain this important element that doesn't exist, you know, in Europe.
It was the 1960s, and the idea of the artist was very open. Also, the reason that Judd wrote and I wrote was to support other artists and also to learn about their art so we can make art ourselves. But in Europe, we did polemics, and Judd wound up doing polemics also. It's a kind of journalism that was very open to us. Smithson, by the way, Robert Smithson wanted to be like Borges, and I think Flavin wanted to be like James Joyce. And my hero actually was the people who wrote about rock and roll for rock and roll magazines. So I've actually done 10 articles about rock and roll. Also wrote about rock and roll to get free tickets to shows. In terms of popular culture, all our art was about media culture at that time. And of course, writing was part of media culture. I just was in love with magazines. And also, I think Jean-Luc Godard, his first films, like One or Two Things I Know About Her, The Married Woman, are like magazine essays. So, but we had access to magazines. In other words, the idea was to get published, and art magazines were actually publishing us.
You mean that, you know, the idea of multidisciplinary attitude was already around. In fact, you know, the idea to not only to work for magazine, but also to interact with bands, you know, the music. I remember, you know, going to Glen Branca, you know, and all this group of people that were, you know, Arthur Lindsay, you know, everybody was not only involved in music, but also the collaboration with the artists was a part of it. I remember going to the Field Glass, you know, and Kissonier studio. So was at the time this kind of interchange very powerful because of the club, but also because there was this need to cross over. And you are a good example of that, having worked with several bands or having written major article of on rock and roll music. How was your experience after, you know, 30 years? Can you think today it would be possible for, or you go for more operatic things?
I want to do a little bit of history. In San Francisco in the 1960s, there was a group called the Ann Halpern Dance Group. Ann Halpern was a choreographer, and she was married to Lawrence Halpern, who was a landscape architect. And the idea was that musicians, artists, and dancers should use dance as psychological self-therapy. The idea was that music was very... And when Steve Reich first moved to New York, he became my best friend. I think I was just always liking to meet people in other disciplines that I admired. In terms of music in New York in the 70s, we had small spaces. which showed art and also artists were musicians. Glenn Branca also became my closest friend. We collaborated, and I'm still doing work of the same type. I did a rock and roll puppet show, which was called Don't Trust Anybody Over 30. It was based actually on a mini opera that I was going to do in Brussels Opera in '88 with Chris Darkon, and I have two rock musicians from Japan to perform. I've done the costume, the puppets. And pretty much, it's about rock musicians who are hippies who moved in the countryside. A rock musician becoming president of America, and it's all about America, the late hippie period in America of the '60s, where we couldn't trust anybody over 30. So I'm still having fun doing these things. I don't think it will go to Italy, but it was in Berlin and Vienna, and it might get it to Paris. It's called "Don't Trust Anybody Over 30." So I think it's still possible. Basically, we do these things for one thing: fun. And, of course, America of the 60s, we believe in fun. In other words, sex wasn't for reproduction. As in the old days, it was the Marcuse idea of doing things as play and fun. And also, I think working for other musicians, with other people, is about the family structure in art. We want to have, we did these small things with other artists and musicians to reconstitute the idea of the family. And, of course, the art world is a family, for good or bad.
Do you think that this kind of experience with the bands or with the idea of exchange, because the bands is performing and is exchanging this kind of relationship, any concert, with the public, it was part of your interest in interacting with the public, you know, all your work, using the mirror, using the exchange of two spaces, or interacting with the video camera and so on, came also for your interest from music, or vice versa?
I was interested in performance when I saw Josip Beuys perform. And here was the artist as performer and politician. Many artists, like Bruce Nauman, were doing performance. So I started doing performance as a critique of Josip Beuys as politician. And of course, use of the mirror comes actually from my interest in the audience seeing itself being as seen by other people in the audience. See, my work against minimal art was about intersubjective subjectivity. In other words, it's about the perception of people being seen by other people who they perceive. We call that now the Lacan's mirror stage, but actually it comes from Jean-Paul Sartre's Being in Nothingness, which I read when I was 14. The fact is, I wanted to be an artist performer because artists were doing performance then. Maybe also it was a psychological thing. I was shy, but I started to teach. And in teaching, I developed a sense of myself as a Jewish stand-up comic. Comedy has a lot to do with this. And I have to say, most of my political pieces have to do with Jewish ironic humor. I learned a lot from Roy Lichtenstein in this area. And my interest in parody comes from Klaus Oldenburg.
You mean that there's a kind of Woody Allen attitude that you develop, being critical to the order? You know, minimal was a Jewish way of reducing image. You know, it was very radical. So you think you brought back to the language of art, you know, against this kind of Puritanism or this kind of absolute formalism, this idea, you know, you also perform naked, you know, just using the camera. So you try to break this kind of limitation about repression, sexuality, and so on.
I have to say, Saul LeWitt's work is very much about humor. He actually told me his grid structure were jungle gyms for his cats. In other words, that was his way of being anti-humanist. And Flavin had a really nasty sense of humor, like his piece Barbara Roses. So there was actually humor there. I actually never liked Woody Allen. I think my work, my sense of comedy, relates most to Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder, who did a film called Kiss Me Stupid with Dean Martin and Kim Novak, which was a kind of a wonderful, dirty joke. But when I talk about stand-up comedy, not only was there Woody Allen, but there were many other people in television who were Jewish. For example, Henny Youngman, who said, "Take my wife, please." Also Andy Kaufman, who was pretty amazing. Maybe it's because my work related a lot to television. In fact, one of my first articles, which Flavin loved, was about the Dean Martin TV show. I think early Godard was very funny also. So it really related to a lot of other things. No, I never liked Woody Allen. Maybe he was too much the kind of Jewish stereotype that I was rejecting.
1974, you know, he made a kind of shift from the, not a shift, but a continuation of your work, trying to include more the space in a certain way, looking at Antonioni, looking at Godard, looking at this kind of interaction with architecture. It was a very important moment, you know, before, during the presentation, the discovery of relation between art and architecture, art and design and so on, seems, you know, a recent situation. It's not. Unfortunately, you know, what is in 60, everybody try, and you, you know, together with people on the West Coast, like Michael Asher, Maria Norman, they were trying to include the space, the emptiness of the space, or the body of the void, as a part of the language of contemporary art, continuing the idea not to make a product, not to make an object, but to make a campus of energy, a space for energy. So 1974 for you was a big shift in order to go ahead and then to do the piece that we did at the Biennale in 1976.
I have to say that Saul LeWitt worked for I.M. Pei, and his hero was De Chirico. He loved Torino. So Saul had an interest in architecture, which we both shared. Also, there was a very important exhibition that's Museum of Modern Art called The Great Russian Experiment about Russian constructivism. Saul LeWitt and Flavin were guards during that time. What I liked about Russian constructivism was it was halfway between design, architecture, and art. And I think my work has always been quasi-functional, like Flavin's use of neon lights. But also Donald Judd wrote an article about Kansas City's 19th century city plan, which was very important for me. So there was always this interest in architecture that I had.
What about Bob Venturi?
I discovered Venturi when I was doing a book about my video projects. The person who did the diagrams worked for Venturi. I actually stopped reading architecture history and art history and art criticism when this wonderful magazine Oppositions came out. So I read articles by Kurt Foster, Tony Viedler, and also Aldo Rossi. His book about the city became very important for me. And Venturi also wrote Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture. So I've really learned first about architecture through their architects' writings. And actually, it's my hobby, looking at architecture. I'm halfway between art and architecture, but unlike Vito Conchi, I'm not an architect. And I like the hybrid status. Also, I have so much enjoy looking at architecture now that I can travel as an artist. So I have two things I like doing, writing articles about rock music, meeting rock musicians, and also architecture tourism. And now I'm a collector, and I'm collecting architects' diagrams and models.
Also, I think it's important, you know, what you have done in the area of collaborating with other artists. You know, we mentioned before, I know, the Glen Branca, the opera, you know, but also you work not perhaps with the final result that was satisfactory with Jeff Wall about the pavilion for kids, the children's pavilion.
Well, the children's pavilion, actually, Jeff Wall saw a video I made for this, a show I did, a piece I did in Chambre de Mie in Ghent, and he said he wanted to collaborate with me because I've collaborated with everywhere from Dora Birnbaum to Marie-Paul MacDonald. And in fact, it's a fantasy project. It was almost not realized. And Jeff's role was very limited. He just did the tondos. It was almost realized in the year 2000 in the city of Blois. It's a children's in a playground. There's mountains for children where they could become king of the mountain. So this is a work that's very influenced by Emilio Ambaz. It's underground. It has Oculus doing two-way mirror glass. And in fact, we did this as a fantasy project. When it was in magazines, Jeff Wall's architect and Jeff put in his version, which is actually not very correct. But it wasn't realized. But it was basically done for fun when Jeff and I were just having fun as friends. Also, my friend Rodney Graham did a song for Don't Trust Everybody 30. The problem with Jeff Wall is he became very famous and they suppressed my name. I think it's important to do things with people in other disciplines, but not superstars. And I find it's hard to collaborate now because my name sometimes overshadows somebody else's name. But basically, all these collaborations are done for fun.
Continuing with this idea of your interest in architecture and my interest in architecture, and you know, I did another show, Art and Architecture, recently in Genoa, where you were included. What do you think, because, you know, continuing the discussion this morning, what do you think about this shift between art and architecture means that architecture has become artistic, is becoming sculpture. After, you know, Frank Gehry, Bilbao, Guggenheim, you know, the idea of architecture become a kind of sculpture element, which is going back to a very old tradition, the expressionistic one. You know, what do you think?
I'm 100% against it. I don't think it's architecture. I think there's a disease out there. Artists want to be architects, and architects want to be artists. All the great architecture is about the function and the interior itself. And with like Corbusier, you can actually, he collaborated with Xenakis in a monastery. I think with some great architects, like Sver Fenn, or in Norway, who's a very great architect, living architect, or Zumthor, the thermal baths, the work is about the body. It's about body sensations inside. And I think program, when I did my Dia Foundation piece, I wanted to change the Dia into an outdoor ICA, a 1970s alternative space, and an 80s corporate atrium, and I really wanted to change the Dia. In other words, the program was very important. I think early Frank Gehry is quite wonderful. He took a lot from Michael Gray's Benseroff house, where he took a cutaway existing house, but I also think his work had enormous humor, Frank Gehry. The chain link fence was about all this interest in security in America, and I think Sarnan's work also had enormous humor. I think the architecture that's in magazines is just an outside shell. It's sculptural, and I don't believe in it. I think it's awful. And I think artists like Jorge Pardo or Vito Acconci, who say they're doing architecture, don't know anything about architecture. So I'm 100% opposed to this. It's a bad trend, but I may have had something to do with initiating it.
But also, you know, let's go a little bit for the audience also about, you know, there's another shift. You know, we have the shift of architecture, but also we have the shift of the museum changing the role and become, I was involved in that too, if you want to, with the Guggenheim, becoming a kind of chain and distribution of project, idea, not only of architecture, but also of art. So what do you think about this kind of development of today of an institution that was supposed to keep art and show art to becoming a machine of theater?
It's a very good question. I wrote an article, which was in Rock My Religion, called Museum is Garden, Garden is Museum, about the shift in the museum. I think I said here in that article that the first museums were Renaissance gardens, which were archaeological digs, theme parks, political and literary allegories. And for me, it was very important in the 80s that museums were all situated near chateaus with gardens. It began with Documenta, which was based around a palace and the garden around the palace. And then Munster also did things that were in relationship to the palace and the university. And for me, the 1980s in France, when the socialist government decided that they wanted to regionalize art, and all the great museums were now in gardens with chateaus. And it's very important for tourism because during the summer, people can come with their family in cars, camp out, and look at art as both entertainment and education. But I think the 90s, museums were about education. In other words, children would visit there, and the education program became important. So I designed for Munster 12 years ago a children's daycare center, which was computer, CD-ROM, and cartoon library to entertain, educate, and take care of children. It was turned down by Caspar Koenig, but then I did a version of it for the Hayward Gallery, Waterloo Sunset, the Hayward Gallery, where I worked with an architect, and we did all the detailing. No, I really think museums are social spaces. And my most successful piece in a museum was Carnegie International in 91. It was in an empty lobby. It was a heart, two-way mirror heart. Because I think museums are about our romantic meeting places. It's a good pickup places, but also pickup places for old people who sit down on benches and they can hold hands with their partner. And I also think the gift shop museum are very important, the gift shop and the cafe. So I like these other social spaces that museums have. And of course, they often want the general public in. The problem with museums now is like the Tate, is what's happened with the Tate Modern. It's become an airport lobby and a corporate atrium. And I think the museums have become very corporate because that's where they get their funding from, corporations. But I think they're great museum buildings. They're in San Francisco, Mackie designed Yerba Buena. There's the Kimball, which is pretty amazing in Fort Worth. But for me, the bookshop is so important because that's where I often pick up some of my best books. But museums are social spaces. But I think the museum is really in social flux. And this is where I disagree with Buren, who's Cartesian, who thinks the museum is fixed. It's always in flux, and I think Germano is alluding to this fact.
So you think that the artists that are working in a public space, like, you know, we are in Faenza, there is no project of doing anything, but normally you are interested in doing a functional object, let's say a bar, a library, a bookshop, not a traditional sculpture. Because here in Europe, unfortunately, there is all the idea of, you know, the peace as a kind of autonomous life, while for you is a functional life. Like a gazebo, you know, your work is with the idea of a public gazebo that become good for taking picture during the wedding or to play inside or to do something that is very functional, is alive.
Well, that's because of the Ruskies. We called them the Ruskies. They were our enemies during the Cold War. But we took so much from Russian constructivism in America. I have to say something you might not know. In New York, we hated Duchamp. We preferred Russian constructivism. Flavin's use of lights were not ready-mades. They're more like Tatlin. I like things that are not completely functional, but quasi-functional. In other words, slightly functional. Public space, that's because we're doing things for a public situation now.
So if you get inspired by the Russian, let's say... The Rodchenko Club for Workers, you know, the 20s. There is not a danger which is around, actually, on the other side, not only architecture, that artists become designers.
I wrote a wonderful article also in Rock My Religion in the 70s called Artist Design is Art. And it's about the 1960s artists like Chamberlain, who did foam rubber couches, Archwager and Oldenburg, who did the Bedouin Ensemble. Also, it's about Venturi's Knoll furniture and Warhol silver pillows. I think now we're overdoing this aspect. I know a certain artist who's quite well known, Andrew Zittel, who got a hold of a book that Emilio Ambaz did called New Domestic Landscape, where he had all the work of Joe Colombo. So a lot of these 60s design artists, they're just looking at books from the 60s. But of course, Joe Colombo was incomparable. He was also an architect. He did everything. So it really all comes from Joe Colombo, pretty much. Although I know Gianni Colombo is also rediscovered.
Yeah, I think it's a very important rediscovery. You know, I was part of the New Italian Landscape, you know, the show that Emilio did, and where all the Italian, you know, the group of Superstudio, Archizum, all these people were kind of integrating art and architecture. But I think today is becoming... And that's the danger of art becoming a commodity, but not only, it become an hedge fund business. What do you think about this shift now that, you know, until the 80s was kind of social utopia, illusion of utopia, and then after the 90s, they become a commodity, not only a commodity, now they become a stock market exchange.
I think young artists are reacting against the 80s and 90s, the corporatization. But, of course, in the 90s, we had New Age. We have Bill Viola. But now it's a fantasy of the 60s. A lot of that is childhood memories of the 60s. I know Eliasson's Serpentine piece reminds me of kind of fantasies like Philip Johnson's Four Seasons Restaurant. And I think they all have fantasies. And, of course, they have access to books. When they go to art school, they're catalogs. So they're taking a lot from books. I think the problem is it's a simplification and reduction. And also this idea of utopia in the 60s. No, it was not a utopia period. It was a mixture of everything, very complex. And, of course, we have wonderful artists who dealt with this. For example, Luciano Fabbro, whose work I admired enormously. And he was very important. For him, teaching was very important. And I think we had a social way of doing things. In terms of design, I think Italy ruled during that time. But also, I think that the problem is that these artists who are supposedly against commodity are actually doing commodities. There's some artists who I like a lot, though, who are experimenting with design. My favorite artist is Heimlo Zubernick from Vienna. And I guess they all admire me, but I don't admire them.
There was also an important function, I remember at the time. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about experience. You know, the Nova Scotia College of Art, which I think was in the 70s, if I remember well, you know, was a kind of school, a creativity of school, you know, here in Italy is Città dell'Arte by Pistoletto. But in the 70s, there was this Canadian area where everybody was going from Richard Serra to Vito to you. I think it was Davy Eskvold, who was the dean.
Actually, the president was Gary Kennedy.
And Benjamin was teaching them, Benjamin Booker.
Well, actually, before, what happened was that I had no money, and I wanted to do film and video. And then there was a course that David Eskvold was doing called Projects, where he invited conceptual artists to give a project that would be with instructions that would be realized by students. So I invited him, I gave a project, many projects, and I invited myself up there to use the equipment to do my own work at the same time. They were doing prints or lithographs with artists, and I said, that's ridiculous. They should actually do monograms, in other words, where artists would write about their own work. So I got Caspar Koenig up to Nova Scotia College of Art to do the book program, and I suggested Steve Reich. We republished the writings of Donald Judd, including the reviews. Also, Dara Birnbaum book was my project. And also, the other thing I did was, they always had people come up there for 2 or 3 days to teach. I said people should go for 3 months. So I set up a teaching situation where I would do the first 3 weeks and the last 3 weeks, and I got people who had never taught before there to teach. Jeff Wall, Dara Birnbaum, Michael Asher, Martha Rosser. I gave them their first teaching jobs. And basically, I love doing things there because Canada was a media culture and had lots of media. Also, I got Simone Forti to do a book there. Canada was a media culture, and I wanted to use media. The other thing was I never went to art school or college, so the idea of being a teacher in a real school without any academic background really appealed to me. Plus, it's a beautiful place, and Europeans love going there during the summer. Josip Beuys to go there for a summer, and also Gerhard Richter. And then I got Benjamin Booklow to teach there, to do the book program. It was a great time. We shouldn't overemphasize the situation, but in fact, Canada was very important for me because I think you have to have another base besides your home base.
There's another element I think is very important, as you said, architecturally. There was the famous show of Leo Castelli when, you know, he tried to shift from selling artwork to sell houses. You remember that? You know, there was a show of models, which was kind of unique. It was a show that everybody loved, but, you know, because Leo was trying to move from one dimension, which is commodity, to offer the possibility of constructing a new house by Aldo Rossi and so on. I think that was a very important momentum because for the first time, architecture was shown in a gallery, not a gallery like Leo Castelli, and secondly, was shown for the visual aspect because, or the sculptural aspect of the model. So in a certain way, what happened, the model became an object to have a life and to have an economy.
Germano is very brilliant because the show was about the New York Five, Peter Eisenman, Michael Graves. And I saw the show just after I did the Venice Biennale piece, and I decided 2 years later to do architecture models as art. And all my first projects were architecture models. Also, I have to say, Leo Castelli commissioned a house by Emilio Ambaz. I don't know if it was actually done or not. No, Leo's show was absolutely brilliant. And I had the idea also of doing architecture models by an artist, alteration of a suburban house. It was in a show at Museum of Modern Art in Oxford in 1978. And the curator was my friend Mark Francis. And many, many artists like Julian Opie, Thomas Schutte, and Leland Zimbel have used this idea to make it into art. But for me, it was very important. And Germano's right, that show was very, very important. I guess Leo Castelli, like Germano, me and Saul Lewitt, had a real interest in architecture.
So in a certain way, it was not only to sell houses, but also to sell the idea.
Yes.
I think it's a very important element. Mm-hmm. It's not for the commercial aspect. It was a possibility that you sell an idea of life. It's an information about life, I think. Because, you know, in the 70s, the shift from the object to the information. And for the first time, I think the moment was from architecture about information about life, I think.
I have two friends who are dealers, Max Prodesh, who actually started showing architecture models and architecture, and also my Berlin and Cologne dealer, Jörg Jonen. He wrote about architecture for Kunstforum, and he also used to... So that idea of Leo Castelli turned into galleries that were showing architecture models and drawings. But Max says they don't sell. He hasn't made enough money. But he certainly got me involved in trading with architects, so I have a big collection. I think it's about collectability also.
finally, because I think, you know, people get burned here. The last question actually is on the situation of today about, you know, this kind of a corporate culture that is imposing not anymore any idea, but also imposing the circulation of, as I said, the different culture, but also a globalization of the culture and the art system. You know, now the situation not anymore between Europe and America, but you, as you know, is, you know, Asia, Africa, and so on. You see this kind of enlargement of a vision, Latin America, which is very positive, which is very informative. How can be this shift not be controlled, but be, you know, analyzed, and how we can be informed, or we can't, like our generation that was only on the two opposite side of the continent?
I'm an American anarchist and a European socialist. So what the socialists did in France to regionalize culture was very important. Also, I like the architecture group Atelier Bow Wow that are doing small museums in different places. The way I deal with corporate culture is to subvert it and undermine it. Corporate culture uses one-way mirror glass. I make it into both transparent and reflective. And I think what you have to do is build a play situation into a more playful. One good example at the Guggenheim was one of my favorite shows there. It was John Chamberlain. It's a very hard sculpture, and Chamberlain put faux rubber couches in the lobby, so people were feeling each other's bodies with the foam rubber couches. It was very sexual and very hippie, and you could look down from the Guggenheim galleries on the top and see people enjoying themselves from a corporate point of view. But the last thing I want to say is I want to say how important an Italian architect was for me, Giuseppe Torani. I did a piece, a very successful, a fun piece for his 100th birthday in Como. And also, if you like people like Terrell or Wheeler, you should look at the Dante Iem project, which was a pretty amazing project about light. And I think Italian fascism is very underrated. It was a great movement in some ways for architecture.
The neo-real rationalism, especially Perisico and Tarragni. Yeah.
Yes. So I don't want to say good things about Mussolini, but he had his good features.
Okay. That's with this statement, Faenza, we can close. Thank you.
Very well researched. Thanks.